it's a problem for underrepresented minority communities if this is the type of information that's being disseminated.
FEMA addresses how disaster relief information was lost in translation. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 10th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, why the Kenai Peninsula has one of the few growing populations in the state.
What they'll do is they'll move to Anchorage and then move down to Kenai.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Fentanyl and other illegal drugs are causing mass destruction and have killed hundreds of Alaskans. Local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies have partnered to address this scourge. Last year, law enforcement seized millions of fatal doses of fentanyl, arrested dozens of drug traffickers, and worked day and night to hold those that deal dangerous drugs accountable. You can help by submitting anonymous drug trafficking tips to the AK Tips app or online at akhidta.org. This message sponsored by Alaska HIDA.
Alaska Division of Public Assistance Director Shonda O'Brien is no longer in her post. A voicemail message on O'Brien's state cell phone yesterday directed callers to the deputy director.
You've reached the voicemail for the director of the Division of Public Assistance. This position is vacant.
State officials declined an interview but said O'Brien, quote, left state service on Monday. The news comes as the division has been under fire for its failure to issue food stamps and Medicaid benefits in a timely manner. In December, KTOO reported that thousands of Alaskans had been waiting months for their benefits. State Health Commissioner Heidi Hedberg blamed the backlog on last year's cyber attack and a recent surge of paperwork. But sources in the division told KTOO there were long-standing problems in the department, including chronic understaffing. In an email to Department of Health staff, Hedberg thanked O'Brien for her decades of work for the state. Juneau resident Deb Etheridge will replace O'Brien. She was previously assistant director of Southeast Alaska Independent Living and has worked for the state's Department of Health before. She's scheduled to start January 17th. On the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, at least half the population, about 10,000 people, learn Yuktun or Yupik before they learn English. Another 3,000 people speak Inupiaq farther north, so when Typhoon Murbach slammed into Alaska's west coast in September, FEMA decided to translate information about recovery into those languages. But as Emily Schwing reports for KYUK, those translations were useless to Alaska Native people.
FEMA paid a California-based translation service company, Accent on Languages, nearly $30,000 to translate information about how to apply for disaster assistance into both the Central Yupik dialect and Inupiaq. Sharon Sanders is an agency spokesperson.
We are given a list of languages other than English that are spoken in the area where the disaster hit that may be a barrier to recovery. We knew that we needed those two Alaska Native languages.
Gary Holton spent 20 years documenting Alaska Native languages at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Alaska Native Language Center. He says what FEMA thought were translations have nothing to do with disaster recovery.
That is an amazing understatement. The only thing you might gather from that is there are a couple of dates, but you wouldn't know what those dates are for. I would say the only useful bit of information in there might be if there's a reference to a website or something.
At least six different documents that were supposed to be translated into the Yupik dialect spoken widely on the YK Delta were actually just a mishmash of phrases and lines lifted directly out of a more than 80-year-old book of indigenous folklore and language spoken in Far East Russia.
Can you maybe imagine if someone, you know, took all of your folk tales and then interviewed your great grandmother about her experiences growing up and had all of this information recorded and wrote it down and then scrambled it and stuck it in various different ways. It would, and made kind of a collage out of it. It's offensive.
Tara Sweeney grew up in Utqiagvik. She served as the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs under the Trump administration, and her great-grandfather created the Inupiaq alphabet.
It's a problem for underrepresented minority communities, if this is the type of information that's being disseminated and people can't even understand it, services to American citizens are being denied, especially in time of need. That is egregious.
These documents were supposed to offer information on how to apply for financial assistance for people whose homes were damaged and who lost subsistence fishing and hunting equipment, as well as the foods they'd been storing for winter. Sweeney says it's even worse than that. She says the documents are insulting.
There's a lot of that historical trauma of being beaten in schools because they were speaking, you know, their indigenous language, and which is why there's a generation of us in Alaska that struggle with fluency.
That's maybe that is one of the reasons why I don't apply for things.
Sam Berlin is a lifelong Yupik speaker who often hosts radio shows in his indigenous language. He says mistakes like this reinforce his mistrust of the federal government.
I've never trusted the government from the beginning. I don't apply for help. I don't apply for things that come around because it might later on come back and bite me.
While FEMA's Sharon Sanders says the translations were not widely distributed, they were sent to at least two radio stations and two newspapers in Western Alaska. And multiple staff members of Alaska's congressional delegation report receiving an incorrect Inupiaq translation at the largest annual gathering of Alaska Natives. That was a month after Typhoon Murbach hit the state. Staff from both Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congresswoman Mary Peltola's offices say they informed the agency that these translations had many problems. In response, Sanders says the mistranslated documents were removed from FEMA's website. The agency also hired an Alaska-based company to continue the work.
All I can say is, you know, FEMA is a people-first agency. You know, we're people helping people who have been hurt, right? So when we don't get it right, that really matters to us. And we work really hard then to make sure we do get it right.
To date, the agency has paid an average of $8,000 per applicant to people whose applications for relief were approved. To put that into perspective, the agency paid the original translation service, Accent on Languages, more than three times that amount, which is also more than the median annual income in the Yukon-Kuskokwim region. Accent on Languages CEO Caroline Lee would not answer questions, including how her company plans to keep this from happening in the future. In a December statement, FEMA said it was committed to enhancing its capacity to work with tribal nations, which includes providing culturally competent services and translating FEMA products into Native American languages. But whoever wrote that statement later misspelled both Yupik and Inupiaq. In Bethel, I'm Emily Schwing.
ABL Space Systems confirmed that its RS-1 rocket experienced an anomaly during liftoff from the Kodiak Pacific spaceport today. The rocket shut down prematurely and did not reach orbit. A black plume of smoke was visible from the city of Kodiak, rising from the area near the spaceport complex on Narrow Cape. A spokesperson for ABL said via email that all personnel on the ground at the complex were safe. The company also tweeted, quote, "This is not the outcome we were hoping for today, but one that we were prepared for," end quote. ABL said it was going through its anomaly response procedures in coordination with the Pacific Spaceport Complex and the Federal Aviation Administration. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, breaking down barriers to lift up the next generation of skiers.
So they can become the professional skiers, so they can become the ski instructors, the lifties.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers degree-seeking students the opportunity to receive donor-funded scholarships, grants, and other financial aid. apply for admission to be automatically considered for most scholarships, complete financial aid applications by priority deadlines to receive optimal consideration. Financial aid counselors are available to assist. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Alaska Army suicides decreased last year. Numbers provided by the 11th Airborne Division for Fort Wainwright and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson list one confirmed suicide at each post and four others under investigation. The total of six is down from 17 in 2021 and the lowest since 2018.
So the numbers are down, but obviously we still have a long way to go.
11th Airborne Division spokesperson John Pinnell stresses that even one suicide is too many. He attributes the past year's reduction to increased focus on soldier mental health within the division, including through the Mission 100 program launched in early 2022.
Dictates that 100% of our soldiers, every single soldier, gets a wellness counseling from military and family life counselors to make sure that everybody has a chance to experience counseling, to understand that it's nothing to be afraid of. It's not going to be a career ender. There should be no stigma associated with seeking help.
Pinnell says 100% of the Alaska-based division soldiers met with military counselors last year, including 10,000 in the program's first 8 months.
And of that first 10,000 soldiers, nearly half have been referred from the counseling sessions to other helping agencies for problems with finance, marriage counseling, other problems that are creating stress in their lives.
Pinnell says Mission 100 also aims to ensure Alaska Army leaders connect with their soldiers.
You know, there's a difference between being in contact with somebody and being connected with somebody. Being in contact is when you see them on the street and say hi. Being connected is when you care enough to stop and talk to the person and find out what's going on in their life, you know, what kind of stressors they're dealing with and how that can be helped.
Pinnell credits the Federal Department of the Army and Alaska's congressional delegation for funding Mission 100 and other mental health initiatives. Trappers killed more than 60 wolves during the month-long season on Prince of Wales Island late last year. Trappers are now pushing state authorities to move the season to the spring to allow them to take advantage of better conditions. But environmental advocates say too many wolves are being killed already, and a spring season would only make things worse. KRBD's Reagan Miller reports.
State wildlife officials say 62 wolves were taken during the 31-day harvest that ran from mid-November to mid-December. State biologists are comfortable with that number. Based on population estimates and previous harvest rates, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game expected that somewhere between 60 and 100 wolves would be taken this season. The state estimated roughly 230 wolves lived on Prince of Wales Island and the surrounding islands as of the fall of 2021. Biologists aim for a population of between 150 and 200 wolves. But environmental advocates are worried. Colette Adkins is the Carnivore Conservation Director for the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the groups fighting to list the Alexander Archipelago wolf as endangered.
I mean, 60-something last year, 60-something this year. These wolves are going to end up on the endangered species list if this type of trapping continues.
Adkins says her organization would like to see trapping stop on the island altogether, but area trappers have other ideas, including moving the season to the spring instead of the winter. Trapper Devin Dolan submitted a letter to Ketchikan's Fish and Game Advisory Committee explaining why he feels that the wolf harvest should be moved to the beginning of March. Dolan was a member of the committee until his term expired this past summer. He also addressed the committee at its recent meeting.
A lot of people have complained for years about ice in November and December and snow and can't access areas, bad weather, short days.
Trappers also wouldn't be in the field around the same time as duck or deer hunters. He says a spring season would avoid snaring deer during their critical breeding season.
Moving it into March is the deer slowed down a lot. They're not quite moving as much. They're still moving, but they're not moving as quite a wide of a range where you would catch them in a snare quite as likely. They're going to be laying a little bit lower.
The Ketchikan Advisory Committee unanimously chose to support a spring trapping season. But Adkins, from the Center for Biological Diversity, says the idea comes with its own problems.
that's during the wolves' breeding season. It's a particularly sensitive time for wolves. And there are so many other ways to protect deer from snaring.
She suggests so-called breakaway devices that have a loop that breaks with a certain amount of force.
Moving the trapping season to March would only make things worse for wolves.
While the advisory committee supported the idea, it's not scheduled for discussion by the Board of Game when it meets in Ketchikan on January 20th. There are a few wolf-related items on the Board of Game's agenda. One proposal from the Alaska Wildlife Alliance would nearly double the target wolf population to between 250 and 350 wolves. Others would change the way the population or harvest level are calculated. A proposal from Ketchikan's advisory committee would open the wolf hunting season September 1st and set a 5-wolf bag limit. Most wolves are killed by trappers, but an earlier hunting season would allow deer hunters to kill wolves that they encounter. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Last year's wildfire season was the largest on record in Bristol Bay, following a trend toward bigger and more numerous fires in southwest Alaska. KDLG's Izzy Ross takes a look at what environmental conditions fanned those flames.
More land burned in the Bristol Bay region last summer than in the past 72 years combined. University of Alaska Fairbanks climate specialist Rick Toman says that is amazing.
In southwest Alaska, we really have not seen anything like this. And the Bristol Bay region was the most extreme of all the extremes.
The Alaska Fire Service boundaries for Bristol Bay stretch from Platinum in the west to north of Iliamna Lake, east to the Gulf of Alaska coast, and down the Alaska Peninsula to Port Hyden. Toman says the biggest fires were the Kaktuli and Pike Creek fires north of Iliamna Lake. But there were other big fires too, like the Iowithla fire, which came within 9 miles of Dillingham.
By far the largest wildfire on record close to Dillingham. And well south of King Salmon, we had that Contact Creek fire early in the season. Again, a 10,000-acre fire in a place that we just don't expect this kind of thing. So really, it wasn't just, oh, there was one big fire. We had big fires, and they were all over the Bristol Bay region.
For that to happen, Toman says, many factors have to align. One ingredient is dry fuel. In Alaska, that fuel is both the forest and the ground cover.
This is very different than, say, the lower 48, where what you're going to burn is vegetation above ground. We have both the above ground and that duff layer right at and just below the surface that is equally flammable. So we've got to get that dry.
Sun, wind, and a lack of rain are all conducive to starting and growing wildfires. And there needs to be a spark. In Alaska, that spark is often lightning.
We had a burst of lightning from the last days of May through the first week of June all across southwest Alaska, several days in a row with lots of lightning. And as is typical for early summer thunderstorms, lots of places had lightning, but no significant rain. And that touched off many fires in the course of a few days across southwest Alaska.
Another factor, snowmelt. Some areas of the region had an early snowmelt and a warm, dry spring. That meant the tundra dried out earlier. But other areas, like Dillingham, had a lot of snow and rain at the end of the winter, which left a high snowpack.
The early snowmelt was not so much a factor, but the warm and dry weather after the snow was all gone certainly contributed.
Toman says southwest Alaska crossed a threshold in 2015. Wildfires have gotten larger and more numerous. For example, in 4 separate seasons since 2015, more acreage has burned in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta than any other year prior. Toman says it's one of the clearest signals of climate change-induced shifts in Alaska.
The elders are telling us there is much more vegetation on the tundra. Tundra vegetation is growing higher, it's growing thicker. In the transition between boreal forest and the tundra, the trees are growing farther up away from the rivers. The trees near the rivers are growing bigger. And all of that means there's more fuel for fire to burn once it gets going.
Toman doesn't think next summer will be as extreme because all those factors would have to align again. But he says if wildfires have taught us anything in recent years, it's that sometimes unlikely things happen. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 45 years of Alaska operations. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich, thoughtful, and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
The chairman of Sea Alaska Corporation and four education officials are the finalists to serve as the chancellor of the University of Alaska Southeast. The Alaska Beacon reports that yesterday the university announced the short list of candidates for the job that will open when current chancellor Karen Carey retires at the end of June. The chancellor of UAS serves as the university's chief executive officer and will be appointed by University of Alaska President Pat Pitney. In a statement online, Pitney said the finalists, quote, are all leaders chosen from a pool of diverse and highly qualified candidates, end quote. UAS has a main campus in Juneau and satellite campuses in Ketchikan and Sitka. It's the smallest of the three schools that includes the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the University of Alaska Anchorage. The five finalists will visit all three UAS campuses in the coming weeks. A final selection will be made after those visits, likely in the middle or end of February, according to Pitney. For the 10th year in a row, Alaska saw more people leave than arrive, a trend that holds true for almost every borough in the state. But some communities are expanding, and as KDLL's Riley Board reports, the Kenai Peninsula is seeing steady but uneven growth.
The Kenai Peninsula borough grew by almost 1,000 people from July 2021 to July 2022, according to data released last week by the state's Department of Labor. That makes it the second largest growing borough in the state, and one of only four that grew during the past year.
Kenai is a big-time grower from migration.
State demographer David Howell says most places in the state, including Anchorage, have seen more people leave than come in. But he says that's not true for the Kenai Peninsula. He chalks it up to Anchorage residents leaving for the peninsula in search of a lower cost of living.
So people don't necessarily move from Door 48 to Kenai directly. What they'll do is they'll move to Anchorage and then move down to Kenai.
The Mat-Su is the only borough growing more than Kenai, and Howell says it's for the same reasons. That migration to the Kenai Peninsula is driven by retirement-age Alaskans. Howell says that's partly because Kenai has less of a military presence, an industry that can drive down the average age of a community. And this has meant that population growth isn't reflected in the school district's enrollment. While the borough population has grown steadily over the last several decades, according to Howell, the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District has seen a downward trend in enrollment for almost 25 years. Enrollment in the district hit an all-time high in 1998 and has dropped almost 20% since then. The Kenai Peninsula School District's finance director, Liz Hayes, attributed the mismatched population shifts to the borough's growth within its retirement age population.
We were seeing a lower incoming kindergarten class than our outgoing senior class, and they were attributing that to that we're becoming more of a retirement type communities on the peninsula.
Hayes and District Superintendent Clayton Holland say the declining enrollment is also related to housing, specifically a lack of available housing for young families with kids who might otherwise fill the schools. Howell, the demographer, says that housing crunch could also be linked to the increasingly aging population.
It is true that, you know, if you have this retirement population coming in and buying up houses, it could drive out the working age population who maybe can't afford to get in a bidding war with these older retirees.
Howell predicts Kenai will continue to grow, as will its retirement age population. Overall, he says, births will continue to go down. Kenai is already below the state's average fertility rate, and soon millennials will age out of what Howell calls their prime birthing years. The generation born between the late 90s and 2010s, meanwhile, is a smaller generation overall and is therefore likely to continue the downward trend in births. But Howell says migration will offset that trend as long as retirees in Anchorage keep moving down to the peninsula.
So I think we'll see those trends continue for quite some time.
You can read the state's full report on the Alaska Department of Labor's website. In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
A professional skier came to speak with Juneau kids last week. Her visit was part of an effort to remove some of the barriers that face Alaska Native youth who want to ski. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has more.
Ellen Bradley is a professional skier, but a trip to Eagle Crest last winter was the first time she'd ever skied in Tlingit Ani, her traditional homelands. Now she's working to help Alaska Native youth get everything out of skiing that she does.
I think spending time on the land can address so many things in a person's life, but I think mental health is especially one of them, to just move your body with the land in this winter time, you know?
At the event, they're giving away prizes like a form-line snowboard designed by Tlingit artist James Johnson. There's live music by Southeast Alaska favorite Yatsin. Bradley learned to ski from her dad as a young child in Washington State. She says it helped her feel connected to the land, but she didn't see many other Indigenous people on the slopes while she was growing up.
Like, I had my brother and I had my dad, and everyone else I skied with was white.
She says the sport can seem off limits, even to people who are Indigenous to the land a mountain sits on. Benson Bullock is helping kids sign up for ski trips with the Douglas Indian Association.
So last year, we got together and my supervisor said I should figure out a way to take kids up to Eagle Crest in March and April and get them lessons, get them gear, just get kids out on the mountain.
This year, he wants the program to get even more kids on the mountain. Bradley thinks that efforts to get kids in skis could mean more Indigenous people in the skiing industry as a whole.
So they can become the professional skiers, so they can become the ski instructors, the lifties, so they can eventually become the people running Eagle Crest.
Rylan Tompkins, one of dozens of kids at the event, could be one of the future pros Bradley is thinking of.
What makes it exciting? I like snow.
He hasn't skied or boarded yet, but his uncle Joe Tompkins is a Paralympic ski champion. Rylan says he wants to learn too. Bradley is hopeful that more and more Indigenous kids will start participating in snow sports.
I think the future of skiing in Alaska is Indigenous.
For Eagle Crest, that future is hitting the slopes in just a few weeks. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Kirsten Dobrath in Kodiak, Claire Strempel and Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Emily Schwing in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, and Riley Board in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Madeline Rose is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. Planned gifts as a bequest to your local station builds a legacy that is long-lasting. Thanks for considering this option. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.